Peter Thompson. I'm from Minneapolis. I'm a retired lawyer. And I have been teaching these 2 weeks. This is the ninth session. We've had kind of a progression of topics concerning war and peace. And since I'm a lawyer, a lot of the legal issues that have surrounded the war on terrorism. Tonight, what we're going to do is take a look at a certain supposition to see if it's accurate. There's been an argument made that really this war is much different than any other war. It's unique. We're not fighting a nation. We're fighting terrorists. They don't abide by the rules. They don't have a nation or a government. And since they don't have any regular strategy, we don't have surveillance, we don't have those sorts of things, that the way we can stay ahead of the curve is through intelligence and through coercive interrogation and through other methods which may require civil liberties to be compromised. So we're just going to go do a little historical examination and test that argument, that supposition, to see if the world has ever encountered things like this before, and then also maybe get a little bit of wisdom in times when the world has encountered things like this before and civil liberties have been compromised. What's been the result? Has it been a positive thing or a negative thing? So before we start that, and that's the task for tonight, and it'll really dovetail into tomorrow night, because tragically one of the civil liberties that has been most dramatically intruded upon is our right to be secure and safe from torture. And so we're going to look at the issue of torture tomorrow. Before we do that, I want to just do a quick run through on this, because as you just heard the different, you know, issues we're going to talk about, one of them might be, you know, which civil liberties would you be willing to give up in order to have more security, to have more national security, those sorts of things. These are all kind of intensely legal issues in a temporal setting, that is right now in this war on terrorism, those sort of things. So what does that have to do with holding? And what does that have to do with our discipleship and our own faith journeys that I take it all of us are really interested in coming up here. So what I tried to do is, just so you have this structure, you know, to think about these legal issues. Most of these legal issues are going to come over here in this category of citizenship. But I think all of us would like to, and I would like you to, and I'm going to do it myself, look at these issues through a different lens. Just not solely as citizens of the United States of America, but through the lens of discipleship as Christians. And so I just want to do 5 minutes on what's the difference in citizenship and discipleship. I had a fascinating conversation with Darren today about things, and in his Pentecostal background and then military service, there was very little difference. That is, those things really blended together. And sometimes discipleship and citizenship may coincide nicely. You know, maybe a nice neat package. Sometimes they might diverge quite dramatically, and therefore it's a conflict. And so all of that goes to say, you know, who are you? What is your definition of these things, and how do they mix for you? And that'll probably depend in large part, you know, how you react to some of these issues and how you would answer some of the questions. So citizenship is basically interested in yourself. That is, what rights do you have as a citizen which you can use in a defensive way if someone, you know, tries to take your property or someone charges you with a crime, can they prove it against you? All those sorts of things. The rights being things like you have right to equal protection, right to due process of law. You know, we have right for freedom of religion, we have a right for free speech, and all those sorts of things. Whereas discipleship, the focus of your discipleship is not yourself. It is the other. And so, rather than the means for enforcing a right, it is a position of the love of Christ, and it is done in terms of vulnerability. An outward going rather than a defensive thing. So these three things are almost exactly the opposite. Self, other, rights, love, defense, vulnerability. Also, we had an expert here last week, John, what would you call his organizational, social organizations probably, and he did a lot of talking about law. And he said the law in its best form is always impersonal. That is, you know, you see Lady Justice has the blinder up, which is the way it should be in a legal system so that she can't make one judgment against, you know, a black that she wouldn't make against a white, gender, race, creed, all those sorts of things. Alan Story, who was here last week, and just gave some inspirational Bible studies, made the comment, he said, Jesus is never impersonal. And so he really talked about it as, you know, matters of the heart. So we have some real differences there. The boundaries, your citizenship rights and your status and even, you know, being a citizen is bounded by the national boundaries. And so, you know, if you go up to Canada, you're an alien. You're not a citizen anymore. Whereas the boundaries and the responsibilities to this outward going vulnerability for the other, it says to all the nations. And Christ broke all the boundaries, you know, the national boundaries, the boundaries of violence, the boundaries of family and piety, the rules of the scribes. I mean, he was about a boundaryless person in his solidarity with all of humanity. So we have very different things here, and the goal of citizenship is domestic tranquility, as it says in the Declaration of Independence, or another way to say that would be national security, and that's kind of the general topic of this talk, national security versus civil liberties. And the goal of discipleship is to bring the reign of God. So who are you? How do you define yourself? We are both citizens, we are all citizens, we are all disciples, but all of us on our own journeys are going to have varying importance of various of these factors. So it's just a structure I wanted you to have to consider these very legal points that we're going to be talking about tonight in having the balance between national security and civil liberties. Any questions so far? Comments? Okay. So again, we're going to test the hypothesis, and let me make it more tangible even. After 9/11, on 9/11, John Yoo, who was the guy who wrote the torture memo, we'll get into that in detail tomorrow, he was a lawyer. And he worked for the government, and he was the president's lawyer. He was President Bush's lawyer in the Office of Legal Counsel. And he was interviewed by a lot of people, and he wrote this Frontline article, and he said, on the evening of 9/11, they stayed and worked late, and they tried to figure out how they could do legal things to help protect the country and to ensure that this wouldn't happen again. And he said he was driving home when he finally got done, and it was quite a dangerous drive because all the lights were off in the whole city. They were off because there was fear of another attack, and so they didn't want to have any light going on. And so he drove home, and he spent the next months in this like war council with other lawyers trying to figure out how they could help the country win the war. And his argument is this argument that in this kind of conflict, which is unique and different, he said, we couldn't, you know, follow the Geneva Convention. We couldn't refuse to do any intelligence, walk away from any kind of intelligence gathering, because the only way we could really stay ahead of the enemy was to find out what was going on. And hence that led him to that situation of writing the torture memo that really opened the doors to torture and coercive interrogation. And so that argument, which has been used many times, let's try and find out if it's true that something like this has never happened before, and when we give up some of our civil liberties, it's all for the good of our increased security. First, I'd like to just have us all join in prayer. Here's a prayer that Alan taught us last week, and I think it's a nice way for us to center and grab a hold of that lens that we have as disciples to look at these legal or citizenship issues. Please join me.
Spirit of the living God, come and grow our faith, deepen our hope, strengthen our love, and water within us the desire to become your faithful friend forever. Amen.
Okay. So, we look at that argument, everything's changed since 9/11, or has it? And don't feel hesitant to, you know, ask questions or state your position or give an anecdote as we're going along here, because it will enrich our discussion to find out where you're coming from. And don't worry about me, because it was my job as a lawyer to think on my feet. I had the wonderful privilege once of arguing a case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, and you get a half hour to argue. And so I got up and I said the name of the case and why we were there. I got about 27 seconds into my half hour presentation, and the judges started asking me questions. There goes my presentation, man. I just had to figure out how to get the presentation in amongst all the questions. So, feel free. Okay. So, here are some things that kind of drive us, and you may have heard, seeing bumper sticker kinds of things, especially right after 9/11, it was very strong. I remember there was one congresswoman voted against the authorization for use of military force, and they had to send the marshals out to protect her house. So, these are some of the criticisms of dissenters, that aliens pose a threat to national security, there's an internal threat from terrorist spies and enemy agents, criminal justice system is not equipped to handle these needs. We're hearing that right now when they're debating the venue for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's trial. And the president as commander-in-chief has to have extraordinary powers in time of war. So, the historical questions are those who dissent, and how have we treated people down through our history, dissent from war, are they disloyal? Do the demands of war justify the suppression of dissent? How do we distinguish real necessities of war from partisan exploitation of a crisis? And can we rely on judges and jurors to preserve civil liberties? Okay, so let's go back. In 1798, there were a couple of acts. One was the Alien Friends Act, and another was the Sedition Act of 1798. And here's what was going on in 1798. John Adams was the president, so this was just at the beginning of our country. And France and Britain were getting into it. And the Federalists backed Britain, and the Republicans backed France. And so there was a big dispute, and they thought we were in crisis, and several of our ships had been taken down by both sides, and then Adams reached an agreement with the British not to do it anymore. And so there was a huge aura of fear about getting involved in the war, and there was a split, a political split about the war. So the Adams government had pushed through the Alien Friends Act, which provided for the deportation anyone who is so charged, you know, didn't have any of these rights, jury trial, right to counsel. And there's a quote from one of the congressmen who didn't go along with that particular act. There was also, same year, a sedition act passed, and it prohibited bringing the government into contempt or disrepute. That's what it said. And so, you know what political debate is like. The Republicans were continually wanting to be in the public square, ripping the Federalists for, you know, taking the action they had with the British. And so there was tremendous Republican dissent in right in Congress and in the newspapers. There was a lot of Republican newspapers at the time. And there was very vigorous enforcement of these acts. And here's a guy, Timothy Pickering. He was the Secretary of State. And it was his job every morning to go get all the Republican newspapers and other newspapers and see if there's anything critical or seditious that was being said in those newspapers about the government and about the Adams presidency. So he basically was acting as the censor. How did I get this guy acting as the censor for you? So, 17 indictments for a seditious libel were issued against Republican newspapers. There was a famous prosecution of a guy named Matthew Lyon. And many people were arrested, charged, taken to trial, and sentenced to jail. What was the result of this? Was it a good thing that they made all these restrictions on the civil liberties? Well, immediately there was a complete demise of the Federalist Party. It fell apart. These acts were all abandoned on the last day of Adams' day in office. Jefferson then came on when he became president. He pardoned all of those convicted. Congress repaid the fines 40 years later, and later it was condemned by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional in the court of history. So here was an event that was a national crisis. Here there was fear. Here there was a great diminution of our civil liberties, and this was the result. So looked like we had been there at least once. In the Civil War, what happened is that Lincoln suspended habeas corpus and imposed martial law. The most famous case was the case of In re Milligan. He was a Southern sympathizer in Indiana. And what Lincoln had done, he had appointed the Secretary of War, they called him back there, to make a list up of people that were suspected of supporting the South. And Lincoln was dealing in a time of true national crisis. There's no question about it. He was trying to save the Republic. But see, the Secretary of War is in the executive branch. And so the list of these people who were then to be detained was being issued by the executive branch. And Lincoln and the Secretary of War defined what the offense was. That is, you know, taking positions contrary to the government. And so then these guys were arrested. They were tried in front of military commissions, which are also run by the executive branch, and convicted and usually executed was the punishment. 13,000 were imprisoned with no judicial review because there was no habeas corpus. This man, John Merryman, was a saboteur alleged to be in Maryland, and he was picked up, and he brought his case to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is Justice
Roger Taney.
And Taney was the guy who wrote the Dred Scott opinion. He was sympathetic to the South. And Taney wrote an opinion that the suspension of habeas corpus was not legal. And the entire system that had been set up for the executive to define the offense, to prosecute the offense, and to carry out the judgment without using either the legislative branch to define the defense or the judicial branch to try the case was exactly contrary to our Constitution and the balance of powers. Then kind of the funny part was, Taney sent the clerk, who was a marshal of the Supreme Court, and he had issued this opinion, And he sent this guy to the brig in Maryland because they were supposed to bring Merriman, the person who was this alleged saboteur, in front of the court so they could have judicial proceedings and see if, you know, he should be detained or not. And when he got to the fort in Baltimore, the army was in control, and the army wouldn't let the guy in. And so he came back, and Taney then sent his order and his judgment straight to Lincoln. And Lincoln ignored it. And so then Taney wrote an extra little opinion, and he said, well, it looks as if all I've got is some marshals, and they have the U.S. Army, so my judgment is of no effect. So this, there were times of great crisis. Finally, after the war was over, another defendant, Milligan, the case in Indiana, got his case to the Supreme Court. The most humorous thing about that was, you know how we know every little detail now? In the Supreme Court opinion, at one point, they get about halfway through the opinion, they're going back and forth and making all these real flowery, you know, kind of language like you'd use in court in the 1800s. And at one point they said, there was some dispute between the parties as to whether or not Milligan is still alive. And so they didn't know, basically, if the defendant was alive or not. And they said, well, on the one hand, we assume since he had lawyers and they were here arguing, they must not have come if he was dead. And so without really determining if he was alive or dead, they went ahead and decided the case. And they, that court, found that Lincoln had exceeded his constitutional authorities because the civil courts in Indiana were still open. It was not, you know, theater of war. And they also rejected the argument, a broad argument, as to executive powers, that they, the executive had the right to function as legislator, judge, and executioner of the sentence. So they pardoned Milligan. All right, well, have we had other international events on this planet that threatened the security of the planet? There was, at the turn of the, from the 1900s to the, or the 1800s to the 1900s, an anarchist movement, which I would say much more threatened the existence of the nation state than the event on 9/11. I'm not doing anything to minimize it as a horrific event. All those innocent people were killed. But look what was happening at the turn of the century. President, these were an anarchist movement that was on at the time. President McKinley was assassinated. The Russian Tsar was assassinated. Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated. The French president was assassinated. And an Italian king was assassinated. What was said back then was this is a wave of terrorism that was completely unprecedented. It never occurred before in human history. That's what they said. That's what they say. What you think you're going to learn is that's what they say every time. And a little bit of it's true because every event is always unique. But to say, you know, we're in a situation now that's never been met before in terms of security is really an absurd proposition. We may feel fear, we may feel some insecurity, but what has happened? We have been attacked one time, we lost 3,000 people, and nothing has happened in the last 9 years, as far as the security of our shores. We have initiated a couple of wars that are ongoing, but the argument is, has that made us less secure or more secure? Okay, World War I. When World War I started, the Espionage Act of 1917 was passed by Congress in their wisdom. It prohibited seditious utterances. See, these oftentimes have to do with First Amendment, you know, freedom of speech kind of things, to suppress dissent. Here's what the Attorney General said. May God have mercy on war dissenters, for they need expect none from an outraged people and an avenging government. There was a committee for public information was created, and they did some PR work. The Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918, 2,000 people were presented. Loyal Americans were asked to act as voluntary detectives. This group, this Committee on Public Information, They put out things all over the country and said, anything you're suspicious about or anyone you think's particularly German is dangerous, let us know. Well, they wish they'd never said that because there's a lot of Germans in this country. There's more Germans in Minnesota than any other nationality. And so they were just deluged after unleashing this fear among the populace. They were just dead. They couldn't come close to, you know, responding to all of the inquiries. So as a result, 2,000 people were prosecuted. The Supreme Court affirmed all the convictions, and there was basically no genuine war debate. It was suppressed. The result, scholars judged the Supreme Court's performance in affirming these convictions as wretched. Roosevelt granted amnesty to those who were convicted, and all the precedents of those cases were overturned as violating the First Amendment. Because it's a bad law. Just think right now, when if they passed a law that you couldn't say anything contrary about your government, almost every session we've had for the 2 weeks I've been here, you know, people analyze the government and will say good or bad things about it, but can you imagine how many people would have been prosecuted? I mean, that's what the First Amendment is about, is to petition for your grievances against the government, to improve the government and improve our democracy. Then we moved to the Red Scare in 1919, when they started being concerned about, you know, the domino theory and the onslaught of communism. And there were some very great fears about a communist takeover, and there were bombings in the United States. J. Edgar Hoover was first appointed as the General Intelligence Division, later to become the FBI. They arrested 5,000 people. They were called alien filth. Those were people that were largely U.S. citizens who were alleged to be communists. And 1,000 were deported. The result was, it was finally determined, the Department of Justice had acted without legal authorization, and the secret police is a menace to free government, free institutions. And these quotes are from later governments. They aren't just from, you know, lefty lawyers like me that, you know, are upset by this. This is kind of the official rendition after the fact. When the Nazis rose to power in 1933, they called the Jews and the Bolsheviks terrorists. This term has been used for a long time. It was used as an excuse for a lot of the Nazi action. World War II, in the Japanese internment, 120,000 were interned starting February 19, 1942. There's a man named Fred Korematsu who was convicted of an offense. And I want to just tell you a couple things about that offense. Fred is a lifelong resident of California. His parents were immigrants from Japan, so he's Japanese-American. He was a loyal, patriotic American. And when the first order came out, the first exclusion order came out, it required all Japanese-Americans not to leave their home. They were trying to figure out what to do. And a couple months later, they came out with another order, and it said all Japanese-Americans on the West Coast had to go report to certain places, boats, trains, various places where they were going to be transported to the camps, the internment camps. Fred was offended by this, since, you know, he supported the government and supported our war and everything else. And so he decided that he would have to violate one of the two orders, either the order not to leave his home or the order to report to the train station. So he decided he would do the smartest thing and do nothing and stay home. So what Fred did is stay home, and they charged him with violation of the exclusion orders and sent him to prison. Japanese internment. Here's a picture of at one of the train stations when the Japanese are being put on the trains. It obviously was a time where there was much fear in the population as after World War II. And the amazing thing is, you know, no Germans, you know, there was a huge war with Germany, but no Germans were turned. You couldn't tell who they were necessarily. So it had to be, you know, a racial distinction being made. Here, Korematsu appealed his case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Hugo Black said hardships are a part of war. And basically, you know, that was a tough bounce, even though he didn't have a hearing or due process to show that, you know, he was not a danger himself to the United States. Justice Murphy dissented and said this exclusion goes to the brink of constitutional power and falls into the ugly abyss of racism. Hugo Black was furious at that language. Anyone recall why? Why? Hugo Black, he was turned out to be a great justice on First Amendment issues, but there was a big controversy when he was nominated to the Supreme Court because he'd been a member of the KKK. He was from the Deep South. And so he was very sensitive about claims of racism. Justice Jackson dissented. Robert Jackson was one of our great justices during the Korean War, wrote the seminal opinion on presidential war powers called Youngstown Sheet and Tube. And in this case, he talked about how the court's power was being eroded. In other words, the executive had gone too far by being just issuing an executive order to have everyone of a certain ethnicity, you know, who lived in, on the coast, picked up and locked up without any due process. Here's Jackson. He was one of the prosecutors at Nuremberg. Also. Here's a very interesting thing. Jackson, in his memoirs, was very apologetic about an earlier case, Hirabashi. Two cases got to the U.S. Supreme Court, Hirabashi and Korematsu. Hirabashi had to do with curfew violations. And so Jackson had voted with the majority to uphold the legality of the curfew. It was the same issue, but it wasn't, you know, as crucial as a prison sentence. Then he dissented very appropriately in Korematsu. In his memoirs, and after he died, they went into his papers and they found that he had penned a dissent in Hirabashi also, where he described war power of the president as the Achilles heel of our constitutional system. He, however, didn't follow that opinion. He just joined with the majority in Hirabashi. But you can see some of the same rationale in his opinion, Korematsu. Well, we all know the result of the Japanese internment was not pretty. The director of the whole thing, Milton Eisenhower, resigned. The attorney general said this showed the power of suggestion, which a mystic cliche like military necessity can exercise. And then later, President Ford wrote an amnesty and gave a $20,000 reparation. Two things. A guy named Ben Sakamoto and I worked on carpentry several years up here. And Ben was interned as a young man. And when Ben told me when he got his check for $20,000, he was offended that someone would think, you know, $20,000, they could put a number on, you know, locking someone up, because when they returned to their farm, people had taken it over. And, you know, their whole life and their whole community, they had a nice community of Japanese Americans, had been busted apart. The other thing is that the guy who really was the crusader, who got the whole internment thing started, was the Attorney General of California. Very bright, politically persuasive Republican, brilliant lawyer, and made the proposal and testified in Congress and got Congress to enact the exclusion orders. Guess who that lawyer was?
Ken Starr.
You got to go back a little bit further.
Reagan?
No. Who is the greatest U.S. Supreme Court judge for civil liberties?
Earl Warren.
Yeah. Earl Warren did it in his memoirs. He was devastated. And he said this, it was the worst thing he'd ever done. But it can show you what can happen, you know? And people were afraid. They were worried about national security, and military necessity takes over. So the other interesting thing about Fred Korematsu is that, guess where I got all these facts? When the first Guantanamo case came up, anyone who wants to be a friend of the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, can ask for permission to file a brief. And once they've accepted a case to hear it, they accept briefs from all sorts of people. You know, retired judges and retired military people. And on the Guantanamo cases, the amicus briefs is what they're called, amicus curiae, were pages and pages and pages of just the listing of the briefs. There were military people on both sides, there was judges on both sides, there were civil liberty people on both sides. It was unbelievable because it was really a very new thing. So in the Rasul case, Rasul versus Bush, which the lead lawyer was a good friend of mine, we officed together in Minneapolis, wonderful guy, Joe Margulies. Fred Korematsu hired a lawyer, well, the lawyer did it for free, and filed an amicus brief. And in his amicus brief, went through all of these factual things. Basically, he was standing in front of the court then again as amicus saying, you know, I wasn't given a hearing in 1942. Now, these people who are under detention in Guantanamo, you should give them a hearing. Instead of being sorry for it, you know, 30 years later. Don't impugn the justice system, you know. Follow habeas corpus and give them hearings. And so his lawyer, Jeffrey Stone, who's a law professor at Chicago, brilliant First Amendment lawyer, he wrote a brief that laid out every one of these things. And of course they did grant cert, and they did give Rasul the right to a hearing. So, the Cold War issued the McCarran Act, and it required registration of all people who were suspected to be communists. There was a Communist Control Act in 1954. Estes Kefauver was the only one in the Senate who had the courage to vote for against it. There were blacklists and loyalty programs, and the Supreme Court upheld the investigations and convictions. The ultimate result of that, the McCarthyism, was the Supreme Court later effectively overruled the communist conviction cases on First Amendment grounds, recognizing the nation had been led astray by the emotions and fears of the moment. You start seeing a word that repeats itself. Darren?
Fear, fear, fear.
Ruled.
Fear, fear, fear.
It's all fear, fear generating.
Okay, a couple personal things. I went to Sri Lanka in 1985. And they were starting off their war, and I met with a lot of the military officials. It was a human rights meeting, and they said, you know, we know who the terrorists are. We've got to kill them all, and when we kill them all, then there won't be any problems. The war will be over. But in the meantime, we have to suspend our constitution and also suspend all of our undertakings under international treaties. You know, so, and those undertakings are like, you know, people shouldn't be killed in custody, people shouldn't be tortured in custody, people should be entitled to have lawyers. You know, some of the basics to prevent civil liberties. Of course, 25 years later, the war allegedly just ended a couple months ago. And they didn't have, their civil liberties have been, you know, suspended since that time. I also went on a human rights mission to India, to Punjab in 1993, and it was the same thing. They said there was a separatist terrorist group, they're Sikhs, they want to break off from the country. And so as a result, this is limited, they're just terrorists. Once we can root out the terrorists, then we'll put our civil liberties back into effect. But in the meantime, we have to suspend our constitutional civil liberties and our undertakings under international treaties. So this thing about it's never happened before, and this is a national crisis, it's unprecedented, and the situation justifies suspending civil liberties, I think is a fatuous argument. And the argument was made again and again in front of the Supreme Court, and all four big cases, bless their hearts, usually by 5-4 or 6-3 decisions, they rejected the government's position that the Geneva Convention doesn't apply, that, you know, civil liberties have to give way to national security. And here's Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority in a huge, big case in 2008, Bomidian versus Bush, that liberty and security can be reconciled, and in our system they are reconciled within the framework of law rather than outside the law.
Why are all the cases so-and-so versus Bush?
Because...
As opposed to the United States.
Bomidian is being held in habeas corpus cases. You have to sue the person who has possession of your body, because habeas corpus means bring the body. So Bomidian sues Bush so that Bush's agents, which would be the Department of Defense that told them in Guantanamo, would have to bring Bomidian before a court for a hearing. A scripture and a theological point. I just want you to read a couple things that, you know, have to do with some of these issues. Here's what Dietrich Bonhoeffer said at a retreat in Germany to other like-minded Lutheran pastors in 1934, as he saw the Nazi rise. And he's talking in much broader terms than we've been talking, but I just want you to read this over. It's pretty amazing. Talks about a huge difference between citizenship and discipleship, and a huge leap of trust that he is talking about here. Laying the destiny of nations in the hand of Almighty God, not trying to direct it for selfish purposes. So, security, he actually says, when we're talking about national security, is the opposite, of peace. So the fact that we may be more secure may not have much to do with true peace.
And what are we more secure from?
Who are we more secure from?
We may be more secure again. We may be more secure from the quote unquote terrorists, which were never really a threat anyway. And now we are at greater risk of our own government because they've taken away our rights, also subtly and insidiously, but they're still doing it.
What do you think about this, Darren? Laying the destiny of the nations in the hand of Almighty God.
Goes back up to the other sentence too. To demand guarantees is to mistrust, and this mistrust in turn brings forth war. There's a missing statement in the middle of that. To demand guarantees is to mistrust God, and this mistrust in turn brings forth war. So you can pay God lip service by saying you're a Christian and voting for administrations, regardless of whether they're Republican or Democrat, because they'll both do the same thing. They'll try and guarantee your safety through the man's law, which can never be done. So if you demand those guarantees, you're saying, God, I don't trust you to take care of me. I don't love you because I don't trust you to save me. They're both the same thing. So to that mistrust, you're depending on the laws of man. And that inadvertent, almost guarantees bring forth the law.
Man, the trust, that's immense trust in God.
That's immense. As I said, you can either pay lip service and say you're a Christian, or you can actually do it.
Yeah.
Well, I just have to protest a little because we, you know, many times many things are done by the government in the, because we're a Christian nation or whatever. And most of those, of course, are extraordinarily false. But on the other hand, we don't have a Christian republic. That's the truth on either side of these arguments. Mm-hmm. And so we probably can't hold Obama, Democrats, Republicans, or anybody to this rule. We can hold ourselves to this rule, but the nation elects them to protect us. Mm-hmm. So we can say this is true for us and for Dietrich Bonhoeffer and for the Christian community, but I think it's a pretty big leap and actually anti-constitutional to suggest that the chief executive should act like this.
I think that's very, this is something, we did a session a couple nights ago about Obama's peace prize, and I think this, I'm glad someone said that, because I think if Obama was sitting in this room, you know, he'd be pretty much nodding his head and he'd kick in a little bit because he used to taught constitutional law. But there's a different thing about him. He took a vow. You know, when he got sworn in, he put his hand, he happened to put it on the Bible, which is a little ironic. But he took a vow, you know, to protect the country.
To uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, which I've taken the same vow.
Right.
Now to say that that Constitution is the truth.
What was the outcome for the author here?
It wasn't very good.
But
now, what was the outcome for the author?
I have no idea.
Yeah, you know,
You know, it's interesting. What was he executed for?
Attempted to assassinate Hitler.
Exactly.
Conspiracy.
Escaping. Which he believed was a grave what?
Sin.
So, if he believed that was a great sin, was he at that point trusting the destiny of the nation to the hand of Almighty God?
No. He's contradicting himself in the act of attempted assassinating the leader.
But as of today, his fate is in the hands of God,
exactly.
Which is where he would want it.
Exactly.
But we're all left here in the hands of governments to try to make them work out. Yeah, we are. One way or another, you are.
You're either free or you're not.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Is the goal on the end of that thing underneath said something
What's
about
right?
the reign of God, yes. and it threw me for a minute because I don't know how much power we have to bring in the reign of God, and I'm not sure I want to. I think we're already in the reign of God, according to my religious understanding.
What I had, what do people think about that? She said, how much power do we have to bring in the reign of God?
Well, it depends on how you define it.
Yeah, well, define it how you want. What do you think?
I think we make that choice every morning.
Right.
And what we do.
And do you feel like you have the power to bring it in? And if you don't have the complete power, does that matter?
I think I have the power to do it if I can.
I think that if I believe I must bring in the reign of God, that means I do not trust God.
All right. I believe I do not by my own reason or strength.
Aren't we living in the kingdom? I thought we were living in the kingdom.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, yes, sir.
I think that undermines the whole concept of grace.
Say more about that.
Please.
Just what I said, it really undermines the fact that we are all sinners and grace is given to everyone, whoever that may be. So we are sin, in a sense, undermining the wish and the will and the God.
I think you've got the power to be a disciple every day.
Right.
And all the people you interact with in that.
Exactly.
To believe that you can be overstepping a bit, but the ability to interact with the people that you, you know, you come in contact with can very much be under your control every day.
That's what I was trying to say, is that, yeah, I'm not going to be able to influence the government by what I do, but I can influence the people that I interact with on a daily basis.
And but can you be a soldier and do that according to what you're told to do?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Can you go to Iraq or Afghanistan and do what you've been told to do?
It's interesting, when the Christians were so became conscripted into the Roman army, and they would have to go out and kill and torture and bring in, when they would return home, they had to not take the Eucharist for a period of time before they would be back in the community of Christ, because of the situation that put them in.
One of the, I work with soldiers on for most of my job, and they're only legally required to follow lawful orders.
Yeah.
So therein lies the discretion. But it's, you know, you get some of the stuff like, you know, what has happened in past conflicts, past wars, Vietnam. Many of those orders weren't lawful. And there were some that didn't follow through.
Might I venture to say that...
Boy, that'd be pretty tricky, though, for
us. It is very tricky.
I mean, here you are, a private, and you got the lieutenant telling you to go do something.
Exactly.
You say, I don't believe that's lawful, lieutenant. Sir?
Is it a lawful war?
But Kelly, at my lay, and what you're talking about, in order to mask your civilians, you have an obligation to make a judgment and act along that line. By the same token, any number of officers were fragged, as the term was used in Vietnam, because their troops did not trust them to lead them, to give them lawful orders, or to execute the strategy that was laid out, that they felt that they were there and was worth supporting.
What was frag?
Frag is to go ahead and throw a grenade or see that your officer is killed or taken out from a leadership position. So that you had the right, so to speak, to do that. Now, the military doesn't like that. It happened in Iraq.
I don't deny that.
And it's not popular, but it says that the leadership the organization ends up looking at itself and trying to do the best that it can.
It's
a really challenging task.
Better. He fires the guy. That's better.
Let me bring you back to civil liberties for a minute. How do people feel about something that just affects each of us, that when you go to the airport, there's all these new security measures? In a small way, you're giving up a right of privacy, you know, to be touchy with things like
way.
That. I think we know how she feels. How do other people feel about that? Are there some civil liberties you are willing to give up in terms of your own security or national security? And if so, what? How do you react to that particular one, Sam?
I don't
care less. Anyone?
I couldn't care less.
So it's okay with you?
It doesn't bother me a fraction.
I don't believe it to be effective. I don't think it has the effect of influencing people. In other words, if this was a planned show, I think it's just sort of a pathetic response that is unquestionably ineffective.
I mean, I fly 150,000 miles a year, and I've got to just put up with it because I have to.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I probably the same amount of miles.
Yeah,
and I put up with it because
train.
I have to.
And frankly,
you can't take the train across the Atlantic Ocean.
But look
but
at
frankly,
all
it's a theater.
It is.
Look at all the employment you're providing to the population that otherwise might be of concern.
That's
so from that standpoint, if they've got jobs, they don't want to rock the boat.
It's like the Civilian Conservation Corps with better uniforms.
However,
less productive work.
Okay, but how about this one? So people don't mind too much but think it's silly.
Right.
That'd be a fair. How about member FISA, where they came out and they found out that under the Bush administration they were wiretapping people without warrants. That's also an invasion of privacy. Is that something you're willing to let them do if it would keep you safer?
If it
Why not, Lola? Yeah.
I have a problem with what are we keeping ourselves safe from? We're just building up walls around the United States and making, I think, the rest of the world kind of look at us and go, okay, I don't know. Why are we putting up walls? We should be, I think we should be welcoming people. And we're never going to be able to put up enough walls and make enough rules to catch every person that wants to come in and do something. I mean, okay, we caught the shoe bomber or whatever.
And the underwear bomber.
Yeah.
Underwear bomber.
But
well,
I mean,
because they were incompetent.
If we just keep thinking about, you know, securing our own selves, what are we securing ourselves from? I don't know. I just think it's
Lola, and then...
Well, I was going to say the airport security is very obvious. I mean, it's right there. We know exactly what's going on, but clandestine kinds of things like tapping people's lines, I'm afraid I can't go.
How about if it would make you somewhat, if I could convince you, let's say I could convince you that it would make you somewhat safer, would you go along with it then?
What kind of a standard is it? Like measured, how much?
Oh, 5%.
There's no reason for it, there's no reason for it to be secret. Just go get the warrant as you would.
Yeah. The airport, what we have to do in the airport, I agree, it's for show. I have a brother who does work for Homeland Security as an entomologist. And what we don't worry about is what kind of diseases that can be brought into this country that would affect, for example, corn and soybeans.
Uh-huh.
You know, we don't worry about that stuff. You talk about Homeland Security, we wipe out corn and soybeans in this country. We don't eat. So, I mean, it's like we've somehow decided that clothing and shoes are the most important thing. Oh, my gosh, it's our shoes that are going to kill us. I think they will. But we don't worry about Homeland Security in insects, in plant diseases, in all sorts of things. They're not even on our radar, and those are the ones that could really ultimately get us. So, you know, it's like it really touches stuff in airports. Oh, we all feel good because we took our shoes off.
There's a few evidence.
Just a comment. I think my impression has always been that we want these things for the guy either in front of us or behind us, but not for ourselves. And we want phones tapped, especially if it's going to be a bad guy. But we really don't want it for anything else. So we kind of put ourselves in a position where we want to catch bad guys, but we don't want it to impinge on our freedom to go through the airport, you know. And we want all these things to happen if there's a... But we don't want innocent people tapped, and we don't want people that we like tapped. And I think that we get, you know, put ourselves in a pickle, and that we want everything for ourselves, but we really want it to apply to the other people.
Right. How about from the staff up there? What do you guys think?
There's no such thing as a bad guy in this living conviction. Everybody's innocent. Even people who are planning stuff, I mean, unless you convict them, they're not, I mean, they have rights too, frankly. A terrorist has rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unless they've been convicted of a crime.
Actually, we're going to talk about that tomorrow. We're going to talk about Omar Khadr, this
biggest disgrace for my government. Biggest disgrace of my government.
Oh, you're Canadian?
Yeah.
Yeah. Omar Khadr was 15 years old, and he was picked up in Afghanistan and tortured and hasn't been tried yet. So we're going to look at the issue of torture and how that plays into all this. Jim?
Before we go, I'd like to take us back to this lady's concern over here with just, I suppose you call it a rhetorical question, concerned about what we can do to bring in the kingdom. Let's look at the world from God's standpoint. Is the kingdom here, coming, in reserve? When will it get here? And our Christian faith says we are in the kingdom. And it's not a matter of whether we can bring in the kingdom, but how we can live to make the kingdom prevail. It may be, you know, a mixture. mixture of ideas and words, but I really hate to go home thinking that we still have to bring in the kingdom.
Good point.
We pray that the kingdom come.
Yeah. Are we living in the kingdom, or are we striving for the kingdom? Or are we near, is Holden feel a little more near the kingdom than when we go down Lake?
How did Mark begin his gospel, and what did Jesus say? The kingdom is here. Repent.
Thy kingdom come.
Yeah. On earth.
Thy will be done. And the word is with you.
But we got to think about that one. What, are you a pastor? No, the gentleman next to you.
I'm a physician.
Oh. Well, we'll have to do some research on that. Let me show you one verse I found that seems to talk about fear and love. And I'll tell you just a little story while you're reading it. I represented this lady, Kathy Kelly.
Whoa.
And when Kathy got tossed in jail for the first time for doing peace work and civil disobedience, and she ended up in prison, she said it was totally freeing for her. Because that was the worst they could do to her. Uh-huh. And she realized that was fine for what she was doing, and she wasn't afraid anymore. Mm-hmm. And you know, once the fear was gone, she could, you know, entirely forgive and love.
Mm-hmm. Now, women going to jail is not nearly so traumatic as men going to jail. Not nearly
that
as likely
facilities
to be
usually there.
Injured there.
In your state.
Would you join me in prayer to close, please?
Washington.
God of all ages and times, we give you thanks for your presence among us. We thank you for creating us in your image, binding us together as one human family. Open our eyes so that we may see your face in all those around us. Strengthen us so that we may reflect your wisdom in all that we say and do. Amen.
Thanks for coming.